Can you hear me? Yes, all right. Let's see if we can do this without getting static. How's that sounding now? Better? Okay. All right. So, thank you. I'm happy to be here with you this afternoon. And I'm going to continue the discussion that we've been having on creativity and spirituality and the intersection between the two. And I'm going to be doing it from the point of view of the painting process because that's what I know best. And I think the people who are in my group or in Claudia and my group will find that they, from their own experience painting, that they'll slip right into this conversation. And I think that you'll also find it applicable if you're doing the other modalities. And so feel free to translate it however you'd like to. First, I'd like to say I was really struck by something that Nina said on the first evening about the reluctance that she felt at a certain point to bring the two loves of her life, the two modalities of meditation practice and improvisation and movement together, that there was some way in which they were both important to her and they both really were practices that were foundational for her, as I understand, and yet there was not a readiness to bring them together. And I feel exactly the same way. I feel like for many years, the practice of process painting was never mentioned in terms of it being a spiritual practice or it being a meditation practice or really even a way in which to go deeper into those realms. And partly it's because we started many years ago and there wasn't a culture to support that, at least in my view at that time. And it goes way back. I remember in those days, people would confuse yoga and yogurt. I mean, it was like so foreign, all these ideas coming from another. And so to talk about spirituality would often raise a lot of hackles. And the people who came to the painting process often were artists and therapists and people from just other walks of life, and they didn't come for something they might label religious. So I think I was hesitant from that point of view, that it didn't feel appropriate to me culture-wise, but also I wasn't ready. And I think that even though I understood and I had a really deep sense early on that this practice of painting for process was a deeply spiritual practice, and that it would carry you to some an incredible depths that you could relate to as a spiritual practitioner, but I didn't have a language for it. I couldn't find a way in which to bring them together. And it's only been in the last 10 years or so, I would say, that I've been able to address them more directly. And so now I do present them at different religious or spiritual retreats and monasteries. And it's really fitting. It's a really good fit. And so I think this week, having this opportunity to really address the intersection between creativity and spirituality is rich. And I'm really happy to be able to talk about that with you more. So I'd like to take you on a little journey, I could. A little internal journey, a little visualization, and you don't have to close your eyes for this. It's just a matter of kind of placing yourself in the studio. And maybe you've walked down and seen underneath this room the studio that we have set up. Some people call it a cardboard cocoon. And it's walls of cardboard and the floors are covered with cardboard. And then there's these white pieces of paper. Before we started, everyone has a white piece of paper on the wall or on a tripod, and there's a light on each person's painting, potential painting. And so everyone has this space with this white void there waiting for them. And so, as you can imagine, in sort of line with the whole philosophy here of process, we don't give you instruction. We share a little bit about how to use the brushes and how to be in the studio together and how to clean up and how to respect each other's presence in the room, but we don't in any way tell you what to do. So you very quickly, upon getting started with this workshop, are standing there in front of this white void, and you don't know what to do because we're not telling you anything, and we're even asking you not to plan. And so this becomes kind of, how should I say, challenging. And I think it's a big challenge. I think it's huge. And I think I want to talk a little bit about what that really entails, because for me it goes beyond a lot of the, you might say, psychological definitions of how we are confronted by that challenge. Have you ever heard The First Words of God by Alan Watts? Anybody? Even Anna doesn't know this. You got to draw the line somewhere. You have to enter the void. You have to make a mark on that pristine, perfect, all potential, and put something there and come into form. You have to be willing to have something show up. And there's a huge resistance to this. There's a feeling of losing something so essential because that white void holds all potential. And for you to dare to deface it, right, with a color or a mark, it just feels like you're entering a field of limitation. And indeed you are, because as soon as that line is there, there's duality. It's vertical. It's not horizontal. It's limited. It's defined. It's red. It's not blue. It's a line, after all. It's not a circle. You have entered the field of form, which is inherently limited. And I think that on some really deep level, we resist that. And I've actually inquired into this a lot, and I've suspected that it had deeper roots, as I say, than some of the psychological reasons we give for being reluctant creators. And there's the inner critic. There's a whole discussion of the inner critic, and there's a whole discussion of feeling inadequate and not having enough training. And then there's a sense of the social, you know, what will people think of me? What will it be? Will I like it? Then there's the whole preference, the whole field of preference. Will I like it, not like it? But they never really, for me, they never touch the essence of what that reluctance is to come into form. And so that's what I'd like to start with today. And I'm going to read you an excerpt, which is from The Intimations of Immortality by Wordsworth. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. Not an entire forgetfulness and not an utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come. I don't know about you, but this sends shivers through me. And I'm going to read it again. I've got to get you shivering. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting, and cometh from afar. Not an entire forgetfulness, and not an utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come. And I have the feeling that it's the intuition of this that leads to our reluctance to come into form. It's our intuition of, you might say, our infinite nature, of the where we've come from, of that in us which we realize and recognize in some level is not limited. And as soon as we are faced with the act of creation, we have to take on a limited form. We have to come down into form. We have to come down into definition, into peculiarity, into definite shape. And it just makes so much sense to me that as I watched people over and over and over again, and myself in the painting process, balk at coming into inhabiting oneself through the act of creation and of wanting to be that definite about it, to show up to that degree. And it just makes sense to me that it's because of this deeply held intuition that may not even be conscious in us, that we are more than that, that this is not us, it can't be us. It's too limited to do that. And so you say, this then puts the the reluctance that we feel to create on a very different level. And it defines the journey as well. Because I think we also know that there's a paradox here, which is through the act of creating, through being willing to fully inhabit that peculiarity, which is ourselves, and all of our quirkiness, and all of our insufficiencies, and all of our fears, and all of our eccentricities and clumsiness, all of that, our willingness to inhabit that, to show up and say, yes, you too, that has a place, that's there. Our willingness to do that and go to the end of that, to really not hold back with that, allows the potential for coming home again, for coming home again to that sense of the infinite in ourselves. And for me, this is really the paradox of the creative process, that through being willing to inhabit so-called limitation by showing up in the particular form and going to the end of it, we actually connect with our true selves. And yet we're still in the world. But we have a resonance then with that which is with infinite in us. And so this for me then creates a way in which I hold the process when I'm working with people. Instead of feeling like, you dumb painter, get on with it, will you? It's like, oh, this is the existential challenge that this person is facing. The can we nurture and give permission for them to have the courage to come into form and to actually take their own shape? And that's the challenge of the painter. It's the challenge of the facilitator. And so I'm going to kind of walk you through a little bit what it's like to paint a painting and what comes up as you're painting a painting. And there are certain principles involved. And you're going to recognize these from the talks that Anna has given and that Anne has given. And these will be, but I'm going to focus them on the painting process because it's very visual, very visible. So here you are in front of this white piece of paper. And I must say, the first moment that finally we've had our circle and we've told you about using the tables, and we say, okay, now let's paint. And there's this moment when everyone goes to their spot and they're standing there in front of this white piece of paper. And I can't tell you how exciting this is. It may not be too exciting for you at that moment, but it's from holding the space, it's like there's such an energy in that space that everyone is grappling with, what do I do? How do I listen? Where do I go? And that, for me, is meditation. There's an aliveness, there's an awakening at that moment. Everyone is very, very present. And you can almost, it's almost tangible. You can almost feel it in the room. And so the first principle, or the first, and by the way, I don't even refer to these so much as principles anymore. They're more, for me, ways of being. They're internal states. They're ways of being that allow you to move forward in the creative process. And the first one is not knowing. And this is kind of a foundational piece, because if you come in, of course, with a whole agenda and you know what you want to paint and you've got it in your mind's eye and you've been really working on it the whole night before you come to the class, you're gonna hit a pretty big disappointment pretty quickly, because you're too full of this thought process and of this agenda and of this plan to be flexible, to be sensitive to the moment, to be more present. And so there's no room for something that might want to enter at that point. So not knowing is a state of being. It's a willingness to put down all of the projections and all of the hopes and all of the ideas of what art has been in the past and where you have been in the past with your art, and be naked in front of that piece of paper. And this one has been an evolution for me, and sensing the real depth in not knowing. And I remember the Zen master Sun Sanim, years ago, sitting with him, and whenever anyone would ask a question, he would say one thing. He would say, "Don't know mind." And somebody would ask him another question, and he would say, "Don't know mind." And I got a feeling at that time that was something kind of important about "don't know mind." But it's only through the painting practice that I see how essential that is, because without that, there's just control and struggle and desire and disappointment. So it takes courage. To be willing to not know takes a lot of courage, because in this culture it's equated with being stupid, being a loser, not knowing what you're about, not being accomplished, you know, floundering, being weak. It's got all these connotations. And so we don't want to be seen like that. We're afraid that if we're viewed in that vulnerability, because it is a vulnerability to not know, that we're going to appear in a way that we don't like. So it takes courage to not know. And then something's possible. Once there's not knowing, you're standing there in the front of the painting, and you really are willing. I don't know. I know I've got to get started painting. They're not going to let me stand here forever, right? You got to get moving here, but I don't know what to do. When there's not knowing, something, a space opens. It's like a vacuum almost. There's kind of by creating the state of not knowing, you're creating a vacuum. Something comes in. Something shows up in that vacuum. It creates a quality of listening. And I was thinking, on a kind of personal note, I just came back from a month in Alaska. And as a young man, I had the opportunity to stake out a homestead in Alaska in a very remote area on the north boundary of Denali. And so I go every year. I've been going every year for like 30 years or so. And it's my retreat for myself, and I make sure that I have alone time there every year. And of course, when I tell people this, the first thing that comes up are, what about the bears? You know, it's like, and people imagine there's a bear behind every bush, you know, it's like, and so they, I would never do that, you know, I mean, being out there in the middle of nowhere with bears, are you kidding me? So I have to tell people, well, it's really rare to see a bear. You know, in fact, it's kind of a gift to see a bear, but they are there. And so when you're out and walking, and I go out on the trails or I'm working around the cabin, there's a quality of alertness because I don't know. There's a potential for a bear, but I don't know. So that not knowing of what actually could show up, but it might be a moose or something else, but or it might be a little squirrel dropping cones on my deck and making me jump because I hear this sound. But those I get to know a little bit better, and I know the wind and the trees. Some sounds are familiar to me, but still there's this quality of listening. And I know that when I am walking on the trails, there's part of me that has extended my boundaries out beyond this body because I am present out there because I know that there's possibility and that there's a listening. There's a quality of listening. And I think that that happens with not knowing. And you might say, well, you know, that's all well because bears are dangerous. Painting isn't dangerous. But painting is dangerous. I should warn you. Because if you really listen, things show up. And they might not be what you expect or want. And you might think, no way are you coming into my painting. I know you showed up and you didn't come out of thinking. You came, and you imposed yourself in my presence, but you're no way you're coming into my painting. And so, in fact, this morning I warned people in our class not to tell me what they don't want to paint because that's dangerous because then I know, that's got some energy and probably does want to happen. So there's a quality of listening that's really important and this is, I think it's fundamental to the creative process is that there's an emptying and then there's a listening and there's something, there's a field that's created that something drops into. And it's important not to confuse this with thinking. A lot of times people think something drops into their field and they think, oh, I can't do that because it's thinking. And I say, no, that wasn't thinking. The source was not thinking. The source was intuition. The source was spontaneous. The source came, but it had to land in the mind in order to be recognized, but it didn't come. The source is not in the mind. So when there's this space created through not knowing, there's a quality of listening, and then something drops in. So then the next challenge, listening is the second way of being I was talking about. The third is, well, then what? Do you respect what shows up? And I know that this is one of the precepts in Buddhism is respect, and I feel like it's so important in the creative process because we are pretty prejudiced against what shows up out of nowhere for no reason, what comes unbidden. And we diminish it. And very often I'll come up to somebody and say, what did you think about doing? And they'll say, well, I thought about this, but, you know. And it's already diminished. It's already put aside because it doesn't fit the mind's structure. It doesn't fit your expectation. It doesn't fit what you think should happen. And so this is really the third principle, which is, can you respect what shows up? Can you actually listen, have something show up, and then give it credibility? And by giving it credibility in the painting process, it means to actually paint it, to dare to then have it show up on your painting. It's shown up here. The next step is to have it show up there. And, you know, there's a wonderful, I don't know if you know about the teacher, M.C. Richards, who was a painter and a potter and a poet and an all-around creative person. And there's a wonderful video on her life called The Fire Within. And at the end of it, she said, "This is what you can put on my tombstone. Not knowing and trusting simultaneously." Not knowing and trusting simultaneously. So this sense of being willing to not know and trusting what shows up. And that's a big step. Because, you know, the fact is the way it shows up is often not the way it's going to look on the paper. The way it shows up in the mind's eye is one thing. But then to actually paint it, and then to realize and to then have to experience the outcome of your feeble attempt to give that form, and it's never good enough. It never matches. But that's part of the beauty of this work, right? Is that if it matched, then you could say, "Okay, that's all I'm done with. Now I'm, you know." But the fact that it doesn't match actually then stimulates you even more. And brings up the question of not knowing again. You have to go back to not knowing. And so there's this journey that you begin to take into the painting process through these qualities of being, you might say. And they're prodded along by the fact that you have to act. It's not you're just standing there like a statue in front of the painting and going through this internally. You've got to take a brush and actually do it. And that brings up so many feelings and so many reactions. And so I think these principles are helpful because they give you a kind of container in which you can work with them, and you can and that you can actually find your way forward rather than just turning in circles. I would say the next one is something that is, for me, truly exciting. It's a potential in this process that once it's discovered, and it's not that it's new to you, it's already in us. It's more like it's recognized. Once it's recognized, there's a way in which you can deeply settle, and that there's a trust that develops. And it's what I call energy. And this is a really kind of bland word, right? Energy. It's got so many connotations. I call it this because I don't want it to become some esoteric. I could call it something fancy, right? And then it would be this esoteric, and then it would be a goal to achieve. And I want it to be, it's something that's already here. And I mentioned this morning in the circle, I think, or was it yesterday, one of these days, that when you watch children paint, if they're not put into a position where they're told to perform, and you're giving them freedom, and there's enough of a structure in the class for them to settle down enough to actually do it. Because I started my career in painting with working with children for second, third grades. When you finally release them to paint, and you've got their little aprons on, and you've shown them how to use the brushes, there's something very magical that happens. And it's like watching meditation in action. The child will go and pick up a brush, go to the table, without hesitation, come to the painting and do something. It is the most natural movement in the world without thought. There's no thinking, but there's a guidance. There's no thinking, but there's something guiding their action. What is that? What's guiding them? And it's different for each child. And of course, there is, you know, thinking process going on in children, and they do copy each other and so on. But they're much closer to this sort of innocent potential of expression and manifest it very quickly, often, if you give them the right environment. What are they listening to? How do they know where to go? How do they know which color to choose, and how do they know where to put it on the paper? It, and, you know, they're not stepping back and say, let's see here, what am I feeling today, you know? And, you know, what would it look good? No, it's immediate. And so I just want to say, this is exciting because we still have this. It's been overridden. It's been overly thought out. It's been put into commercial. You can buy it, supposedly. But the fact is, it's we still have it, and it's essential to our being. And it can't be organized. It's not something you could ever organize. It's too vital, too alive, and it does not come from the mind. And so that's the next thing that you listen to, because here you are, you've opened the door through not knowing, you've listened, something shows up in your space. The next question is, does it have energy? It doesn't mean that you have to paint everything that comes into your space. You don't. There is a discrimination, but it's natural. It's not a thinking discrimination. It's like, and sometimes I'll ask people, does the brush want to paint it? And that sort of shifts you a little bit, because you're thinking, well, it's not whether I want to paint it, but does my brush want to paint it? Or sometimes I'll ask somebody who tells me that they're really bored. Sometimes people will tell me, you know, I am so bored with this painting. I mean, this is just, I got to keep standing here and doing this? And I'll say, well, are you bored or is your brush bored? And she'll say, oh, well, my brush is not bored. But, you know, my brush is kind of happy doing these marks, but I'm bored. This is a boring painting. And so do you see the two voices there? There's the personality, the ego voice, which thinks this is a pretty stupid painting and I'm wasting my time and what am I getting out of this? And there's the actual experience of painting, which is the brush is happy. The brush could do these dots forever. And it's kind of humiliating to the ego, thinking, dots? More dots? How many dots can I do? I'm going to do a week of dots, for Pete's sake? But what if the brush were happy for a week doing dots? So there's a quality of energy. I call it energy. You could call it affinity is another nice word that I like to use. But affinity is more of an attraction, because very often what has energy is something that repulses us as well. And that's when I mentioned about being careful about telling us what you don't want to paint. Because very often what you think you don't want and you're repulsed by actually has a very strong energy and is actually a call to you. It's the energy itself that's the call. The valence of the energy doesn't matter even, whether it's positive or negative. It's the energy. And if you listen to the energy, you're listening to a guidance, a quality of guidance that is beyond the mind and that you can trust and that comes from a very, very deep source. And this is why I say it's so exciting, because we're all looking, I think, for that source, for that guidance, for that in us to listen to that we can trust on a deep level that is not partial, that doesn't have a vested interest, that isn't motivated by a desire, that comes from another place. And you can discover this in painting. That guidance is there. That energy is there. And it's not far away. It's something that is inherent to our very presence. So that's something that we work a lot with, is this principle of energy. But then there's another one that Anna mentioned this morning, having to do with dealing with difficulty. And this is a big one, because if you're going to paint, you're going to get into difficulty. There's no way around it. You're going to get stuck. You're going to find yourself judging. you're going to want to run out of the room at times. You're going to want to sneak that painting off the wall. We were laughing this morning because we asked that you connect with us before you finish the painting, because we work with completion, and sometimes people think, I can get away with it. They're not looking, you know. I'm going to sneak this one off the wall, and I put it. And sometimes we find them crumpled up in the waste paper basket, and as though you're actually getting away with something, you know. But dealing with difficulty, because difficulty arises, and sometimes it's mild. It's just kind of, I'm not sure I like this one, and sometimes it's really intense, and sometimes there's suffering involved. There can be a very, very deep confrontation within yourself that the painting process elicits. It could have to do with memory. It could have to do with all sorts of things. But you can trust. I think the real message is difficulty has its place. Difficulty is precious. And this is another major about face, right? In terms of the way we are in the world generally. Like, we don't want difficulty. We want peace and harmony. And that's, after all, you know, that's why we are on a spiritual path. But the fact is, we can't avoid difficulty. We can't avoid situations that come that bring suffering, that bring challenge. And I say that in the painting process, you can learn something about this. That's very, very precious, that each difficulty that arises is a doorway. It's not random. It doesn't show up to bother you. It's not just because you're deficient and there's something wrong with you and you're not doing it right. It's there for a reason. It's got a call to you. It is calling you to it. And so Anna addressed this morning. She said one of the techniques in Buddhism is to exaggerate it, to make it even bigger. And we use this in the painting process. We'll often say, if somebody tells me, you know, my painting is just, it's so chaotic. I mean, look at this mess. This is horrendous, this mess that I've made. And Claudia or I might say, could you make it messier? And you'll say, are you kidding me? Of course I can make it messier, that's no problem. But then, lo and behold, if you actually do it, you find yourself enjoying messiness. There's a way in which it can feel so good to make a messy painting. It's incredible how good that can feel. And then you find yourself back in the flow, and it's like, what happened? Where did the block go? Well, the block disappeared because you joined yourself. You inhabited your experience. The experience you were having, which was of making this messy painting, you gave yourself permission to go completely there. And you followed it. And then, of course, there's more space, and you're a happy painter for a while, until the next one arises. But you discovered something. You discovered that block or that difficulty was actually a doorway. That there's a seed within the block that is the guidance, that is calling you someplace. And if you follow it, you're going to feel more whole by going through it. And this is true for all sorts of difficulties that arise. sadness, there can be a sense of sadness, for example, or anger, or fear. And inevitably, if you look at them as something, as a gift to you, as something that has come out of this creative space beyond ourselves and has shown up in your field for a reason, and that it's asking something of you. And it's not asking you to get rid of it. It's not asking you to get over it. It's not asking you to try to resolve it even. It's asking you to experience it, and to have the courage to experience it fully. And magic happens then. You find yourself transformed. There's a way in which the self that enters that experience dissolves, and there's a new sense of your own presence when you come out of it. And so this is a large part of the experience, by the way, because we have a lot of difficulties. I mean, man, they show up pretty quickly. We start a painting workshop, and maybe we have 3 hours, and you'd think at least the novelty would last 3 hours, but it doesn't. You know, we get in trouble right away, and so it's important to learn that this is part of it. This is an important part of the process, is getting in trouble. And sometimes I call it a because sometimes people feel like they're really battling, right? Like it's kind of a war going on. And I say, it is a battle. It's a holy battle. It's a sacred battle. There's something at stake here. It's asking for your presence to be more fully brought forward. It's asking you to wake up. And if you don't, then you're going to stay stuck. You're going to stay in this place where you don't feel fully in yourself. And sometimes it takes longer, and sometimes it's shorter. But if you're willing to hang in with it, if you're willing to keep your 2 feet in front of this piece of paper, and despite all of the objections and all of the challenges that are coming up, you keep the movement going, the door will open. And I think the more you experience that, the more you come to trust that in yourself. You become less afraid of difficulty. You come to recognize it as a gift and as a new possibility in your life that it can open. So then another one that comes up a lot, and especially as you get more painting, as you start to paint, you'll notice that the mind begins to create a narrative around the painting. So you're innocently painting along, and you've been listening, and you've been going through all these ins and outs of it, and pretty soon, you know, you've got this, oh, I see this. This is my higher self here. And these are my obstacles down here in this corner. And I am evolving from my obstacles to my higher self. And so there's a kind of, and so the mind has created a narrative. It can be any narrative. It doesn't obviously have to be that one. But the mind does this. And somebody asked me in the circle this morning, like, what do I do with this narrative? I mean, how do I stop it? And I said, you can't stop it. There's no way to stop it. It's just the nature of the mind to create a narrative. But you don't have to jump on the bandwagon. That's the whole key. And because the tendency is, once you jump on the bandwagon, the painting then becomes about the narrative. And then you have the security of knowing where you're going and why you're doing what you're doing. And you have the security of knowing what happens next, because it's going to fit the narrative. And then you'll notice the energy start to diminish. And you'll notice yourself getting less interested, and there's less vitality, and you don't feel like painting any longer. It's because you know too much. The narrative has taken over. So, well, we often ask the question, when the narrative starts to take form with someone, and you can often tell by that person's posture in front of the painting, because they're sort of like this, you know. And you'll say, I'll ask what the narrative is, so I get to know what their story is. And then I'll say, but is the narrative leading the painting, or the painting leading the narrative? Who's in charge here? And very often, it's the narrative that is always trying to usurp control. It's wanting to plan, to know where it's going, to know what it's about, and to tie the painting up in a nice little knot at the end, a little bow, and to have a nice thing to present. And then you get really bored, right? As soon as you get that far with your narrative, you just feel like, oh, brother, what? I signed up for this class for 5 days, you know? So the last one that we come to is completion. And this is really, really, how should I say? It's kind of fundamental to this process. And I'm not sure that I have a real analogy in spiritual practice or in meditation for completion, and maybe Anna could talk about this at some point. But there's how do you know when you're finished? You've come through all of these different phases with your painting, and maybe it's filled up. Maybe there's a lot of paint there, and it's all filled up. Are you finished? What determines that? Is it because the narrative has been told? You know, well, that's not, we're saying that's not the deal. It's not about the narrative. Is it because you like the looks of it? Is that it? Because, oh, it's kind of cool? Often people want to be finished because they don't like the looks of it. Right? Let me out of here. Get this one off the wall. The next one's got to be better. You know, I'm done. What constitutes completion? That's a really, really interesting question. And so we explore that in each painting. We ask people to connect with us at that moment when you think you're finished, and we talk. And it's not like we know. It's not like Claudia or myself have the you're done and you're not done. It's not like we're some authority, but it's more feeling the essence of completion itself and whether that's you've come to that. And what is that then? It's not so much the paper, the paint on the paper. It's not what it looks like. It's an inner state. All of these are inner states. And so the completion is really, it's having come to something in oneself. And I want to say it's different for each painting. And sometimes people want to categorize, like, okay, if I feel this and this and this, then I'm done. But, you know, it's more alive than that. And but it's real. And that if you don't go to the end of the painting, if you somehow abandon it before you reach that completion, you're abandoning something in yourself. And you're abandoning this potential that I talked about earlier of recognizing something infinite in yourself. Because if you stay through to the completion, there is a very, very definite feeling of expansiveness, of being grounded, of somehow being home again, and of being in your own skin in a much fuller way. And you feel it, and you just realize, I'm willing now to put more on the paper, but I'm done. I'm finished. But if you stop before that time, that process that you have been working through and that's been unfolding gets truncated, and then it becomes baggage that you carry into the next painting. And you find yourself then starting already under a kind of weight of that which is unfinished and that which you abandoned, that which you turned your back on, that which you were afraid. That's where you said no rather than where you said yes. And so this becomes, in a way, the completion embodies all of the other principles, because here you are with a full painting. You've been working on it for hours. You might even think there's no room left in it. And you have to come back to not knowing to complete it. To have the completion, you have to be willing to not know. And so this is what we're doing as we're having the completion conversation with you, is giving you the opportunity to allow not knowing to yield more fruit, and then to check to see if it has energy. And sometimes painting have layers upon layers upon layers of completion. You think you're done, you're convinced you're done, and then, well, there's a little bit down here. An hour later, you're still working down there with all this detail. Now I'm really done. You look at it again, but, you know, I did think of doing this up there, but it doesn't fit. But now since you mentioned it, I'll go ahead and do it. An hour later, you're still working on the painting. It can have legs. The completion can carry you so much further after you think you're finished. There's tremendous surprises after you think you're finished. And each one of these drops you down into another level of yourself, because you've been willing to let go. To complete a painting, you have to be willing to let go of liking and disliking. If, for example, you are wanting out, you think, you know, I got to get out of this painting. I can't stand it any longer. You're not done. And because you're rejecting, right? You're not in an equanimity. You're not in a place of equanimity. And if you feel like, you know, I really love this painting, and if I put one more thing on it, it would ruin it. It's just perfect the way it is. You're not done. There's still a clinging or a pushing away, right? So you can see that then this is a return to each painting offers you the opportunity to inhabit yourself in a new way, to individuate. Jung called it your own personal combination. Each of us has our own way. If you were to paint, and those of you who are painting, you'll notice you have your own personal combination. You have a way of using color, of making lines. Your paintings have a similarity about them. There's a continuity. I can recognize a person's painting. If they start one when I'm not there, and even if they've moved in the room, I'll say, oh, that's so-and-so's painting. There's a imprint. There's a personal pattern that we all have. And the painting is in a sense, each painting is offering you an opportunity to inhabit that part of that new part of yourself fully. And when you do, and you go to the end of it, and you've really said yes to it, there's a new space. There's a place in which you feel deeply satisfied. And there's an attraction to come back. You realize, wow, this is serving me. I'm interested. I'm intrigued by this. I want to go back. And if you take a painting class where somebody starts telling you what to do, it's like, no, stop. It's okay to take a painting class and learn techniques, but we have a hunger for the mystery, for the unknown. And the painting is just is one way of, in a very visual and immediate way, of engaging that. So you can probably see that I'm still excited about doing this, even after having done it for so many years. And I hope that was helpful for you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.